Good morning, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick, the Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University, and I will serve as your moderator for today's program. Before we go further, please take a moment to silence your cell phones, your PDAs, and your other noise-making devices. I see a few people doing that. Today's program is co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University and the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center at Cal State University, Long Beach. Before we begin, I'd like to take the opportunity to tell you about a couple of upcoming programs for the Commonwealth Club. On May 3rd, the Skoll Foundation's Dr. Larry Brilliant will talk about fighting global health threats. And on May 25th, the president of the American Medical Association takes questions on patient health. To learn more about the programs of the Commonwealth Club, please visit their website at thecommonwealthclub.org. Now on to today's exciting program. Thought leaders in transportation technology and workforce development have come together for this full-day summit on emerging career pathways and how best to prepare the transportation workforce of the 21st century. We will be discussing a lot of initiatives and will be answering such questions as how can schools work with transit leaders to better prepare education and training opportunities? What skills will be needed to plan and construct a world-class transit system? What technologies will be necessary for clean freight systems to be competitive on the regional, state, and national levels? Our focus will be on innovative technology, including intelligent transportation systems, high-speed rail, big data, smart freight, and others. We'll begin this exciting program this morning with a keynote presentation from Dan Richard, the chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. That talk will be followed with a morning panel on the skills needed to build and operate a sustainable transportation system. We'll then break briefly for lunch, which will be provided, and a networking session. We'll reconvene with our afternoon keynote, who will be Carolyn Flowers, the acting administrator for the Federal Transit Administration. That will be followed with an afternoon panel, which will look at creating the transportation workforce of the 21st century. Now, you will find question cards on your seats. If you have a question, we ask that you complete these cards and just hold them up. Volunteers will collect them and bring those to the stage for our moderator to ask to our keynote speaker and panelist. And now, to provide an overview of today's topic, it's my pleasure to introduce Thomas O'Brien, director of the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center at California State University, Long Beach. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be partnering with you in this exciting and important endeavor today. You know, among the more interesting news items from last year was a report that a graffiti artist named Katsu defaced a six-story billboard in Manhattan. It was a Calvin Klein ad featuring Kendall Jenner, and that wasn't even the noteworthy part. No, the interesting thing was how he did it. He used a drone. We are in uncharted waters when it comes to transportation of the future and our ability to respond to both the opportunities and the challenges that that they bring. In 2010, Mineta, the Mineta Transportation Institute, and the MetTrans Transportation Center, of which Cal State Long Beach is a part, sponsored a workforce summit in Southern California. And at that time, we couldn't have imagined, or we didn't imagine, that the largest ride-sharing company in the world wouldn't be a taxi company, or that the biggest de facto hotel chain in the world isn't a hotel chain. It's Airbnb. And today we'll be hearing a lot about the opportunities and challenges that this new world brings to us. But I think it's worth reminding ourselves about some of the issues that we have to address from the workforce development side to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. Some of these issues are related to changing demographics and the development of a generation of students that may or may not be prepared to plan for, design, and develop the transportation systems of the future. The Georgetown Center on Education and Workforce has done a number of studies in this area, and they've identified some key issues that we have to address. Today, the majority of transportation jobs are filled by males without any post-secondary education. And in just 2 years' time, 49%, nearly half of all the job openings in transportation, some 1.7 million jobs, are going to require some form of post-secondary education. This is part of the 30 million jobs that will require some college coursework or a post-secondary certificate to keep the U.S. economy moving forward over the same time period. Here in California, the problem may be even more acute. California alone is expected to need about 650,000 graduates of college-level programs to keep pace. Skill-based technological change is also raising the level of required skills needed, even for high school-level jobs. And part of the problem is that upskilling of the education sector lags the modernization of the workforce. So that's a challenge for us in the academy. And I don't know that we've done a great job of anticipating the needs of a workforce that's highly mobile and with high rates of turnover. That suggests a need for educators in the industry to coordinate, to work together on both traditional degree programs as well as reskilling opportunities as part of professional development programs. And to accomplish this, we are part of the world of transportation, I think need to do a couple of things that I hope we'll talk about today. First, we need to study the demographics to better understand where our future students and future workers will be coming from, redefining both educational offerings and jobs as a result. Both retirees and Gen Yers may create a demand for more part-time work, something akin to a casual workforce. Both will also demand new ways of being educated and trained involving various kinds of platforms in the classroom, on the road, via the web and social media. And both industry and the education sector also need to adopt a culture of permanent change. For those of us in education in particular, this can be a challenge, where inertia rules. But we need to understand who our competitors are and stay one step ahead of them, including embracing new forms of technology, the focus of today's discussion, that meet the workforce needs of those in the industry. And we need to recruit industry as a partner in making transportation an attractive option for students choosing college and career pathways. And that partnership is critical because our state, California, has the highest student-to-guidance counselor ratio in the nation, something akin to 900 to 1, when the national average is about 280 to 1. So that makes the work that we're doing more difficult, but even more important. It's clear that the challenges stretch from the K-12 classroom to the workplace, but doing nothing is not an option. The future of the transportation industry is at stake, and I look forward to having that discussion today on moving forward to the solutions with a really high-level group of speakers. And now to begin that discussion. Our morning keynote program begins with Dan Richard, who is our and our moderator, Tim Rainey, the executive director of the California Workforce Investment Board. As required by the Workforce Investment Act of 1998, the State Board is responsible for assisting the governor in the development, oversight, and continuous improvement of California's workforce investment system. Previously, Mr. Rainey was the director of the Workforce and Economic Development Program of the California Labor Federation, so please help me welcome Tim. We'll get us started.
Good morning and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. As you know, I'm Tim Rainey, Executive Director of the California Workforce Development Board and your moderator for the program. My dream actually has come true to be on the Commonwealth Club. My next is to be on Terry Gross's Fresh Air and be interviewed by Terry Gross. Terry Gross, I am available. Give me a call. Today's program is being co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute, San Jose State University, and the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center. And now it's my pleasure to present our distinguished keynote speaker, Dan Richard, chair of California's High-Speed Rail Authority. Mr. Richard was appointed to the High-Speed Rail Authority by California Governor Jerry Brown in 2012 and was then elected chair by the board. He's been a principal of Dan Richard Advisors since 2010. Mr. Richard was an elected member of the San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit District from 1992 to 2004, where he served twice as president of the board. At the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, he's led efforts to secure $4 billion in capital for system rehabilitation projects, the transit system's expansion to the San Francisco Airport, and seismic retrofit programs. Please welcome Dan Richard.
Thank you, Tim. I'd like to start by thanking the Commonwealth Club of California for inviting me back. It's always an honor to participate in your very thought-provoking programs, and also to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute and Dr. Karen Philbrick, as well as the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center and Dr. O'Brien for hosting this conference today, which really brings together, I also want to pay tribute to the emeritus director of the Mineta Institute, Rod Diridon, who has been one of the luminaries in the transportation field in California for many decades and served, before I did, on the California High Speed Rail Authority Board to help launch this very audacious endeavor that we're about these days. Today's conference focuses on two things that I think are essential to any successful society, and that is investment in our physical infrastructure and investment in our human capital. If we can get those two things right, then our society can move forward through the 21st century. And I really applaud the sponsors for highlighting the problem of the looming shortage of qualified technical workers, both at the college-educated level and other technical expertise, that we're going to need to really drive these investments in the future. I'm passionate about infrastructure investment. And I'm passionate about it because I think it undergirds everything that helps build our economy and, more than anything else, to provide good, middle-class, sustainable employment for Americans into the future. We sit here in the spring of 2016 in a political season where candidates of all stripes are focused on what has been the hollowing out of America's great middle class. And I personally think this is one of the crises that has faced our nation, because it's the middle class and the ability of people to get good, long-term, sustainable jobs with benefits to allow them to raise their families, send their kids to college, and to propel us into the next generation. This is a challenge of our times. And yet, we do have an opportunity to move forward, both rebuild our economy and educate the next generation of Americans and provide them those great opportunities. So I stand here today as being privileged to be chair of the High Speed Rail Authority and helping to lead this program in California. And for those of you from outside of our state, the first thing you need to understand is that for a great infrastructure project like this, I've been told again and again and again, the most essential element to make it happen is to have leadership at the top. And we are fortunate in California that Governor Brown sees that this state needs to be investing in a modern transportation system, investing in a modern water system, investing in a modern education system. All the things that we know we're going to need to keep our state moving forward. And the governor has been very articulate with the people of California that these are important investments, and that even though they can be controversial at times, and even though public enthusiasm for large-scale infrastructure projects has flagged on occasion in response to well-noted overruns and things like that, that these are still essential things for us to be doing. And let me take a moment and talk first about why it is we are committed to building this modern transportation system for California and what it means. Then I want to talk about specifically how we are today employing people and what the needs will be in the future for projects like ours. Excuse me. So I came to California in 1978. Like many Californians, I came from somewhere else. And when I came here in 1978, there were 22 million people in California. Today there are 38 million people in California. So by 2050, which is about as long from now as it was since I've been here, there will be 50 million people in California. The infrastructure on which this state operates was in large measure built after World War II in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And in fact, our current governor's father, Pat Brown, was the great builder of California. He helped build the university system, the master plan for California's University of California system. He pushed that through. He built the great water system that conveyed water resources from the north, where they were more plentiful, to the south, where they were not. And he built a highway system, which was the transportation system of the age. He was a builder. And yet, in many respects, we today are living off of the investments that our parents and even their parents made in our infrastructure. And I am going to say to you that I think it is our moral responsibility to be making these investments for our children and their children, because otherwise we leave them a world that is crumbling if we are too stingy or too lazy to do the hard work of building for the future. So that is what we're looking at today, is that in order to sustain mobility for what is now the world's eighth largest economy, we have to expand our transportation system, our water system, and other associated infrastructure. Now, there are a number of ways we could do that. We could build more freeways. We could build 4,300 lane miles of freeways to accommodate those 50 million people and just have the same level of mobility that we have today. Is that what we should do? No, it's not. And the reason it's not is because we now know that there are other imperatives for us, that not only must we build, but we have to build in a way that is sustainable, a way that allows us to do this without overburdening our physical environment or contributing further to the very dangerous process of global warming that just about everybody agrees needs to be addressed by our generation now. So we have to build, but we have to build in the right way. And a modern electrified transportation system, and not just high-speed rail, because California is committed not just to high-speed rail, but to an entire modernization of our rail system through the regional and local systems that we have in Los Angeles and San Francisco and San Jose, and new systems that we're building throughout the state. So we're looking at this as a broader transportation picture. And in fact, our legislature in 2012 appropriated what will turn out to be a $13 billion rail modernization program for California. Now, I always like to say that it's kind of funny, because California has long been viewed as a auto-centric, car-loving place. And in some ways it is. I mean, there aren't many places in the world that write songs about their cars. Whether it's the little Deuce Coupe or the little old lady from Pasadena, we have celebrated a car culture in California. But what people don't realize is that three of the five busiest Amtrak routes in the United States are in the state of California, including in our Central Valley of California, a place that a lot of folks don't think about. The San Joaquin trains, which is the fifth busiest Amtrak route and carries 1.2 million passengers a year, growing at double digits. So while we're a car-loving culture, Californians actually also do love their trains. And we are looking at a future that is going to have much more emphasis on modern, electrified, clean, sustainable rail, both within our regions and between our cities. So what is the high-speed rail program doing in California? Well, the goal of the high-speed rail program is not just to build a fast train. The goal of the high-speed rail program is to connect regions of our state. The New York Times had a very fascinating article recently about how this kind of connectivity has grown regions throughout the world, and that there's a new emphasis among urban planners on connection. And here in California, we have the opportunity not only to connect our megacities in the San Francisco-San Jose region with our megacities in the Southern California area. And by the way, I should say, that is currently the busiest short-haul air traffic route in the United States between San Francisco and L.A., with 40% of all of those flights delayed by weather. So, again, looking to the future, is that a sustainable model to try to move people from north to south and vice versa? It is not. There's another important element of this connection that I want to talk about for a moment, and it's something that most Californians and people outside of California don't really think about. And when we talk about connections, one of the things that's really critical, in my view, is that we connect areas of our state that have been left behind. Now, in California, people often think that we are divided north and south. There's the famous sports rivalries between the Giants and the Dodgers and so forth. But in fact, as I've learned over the last 4.5 years traveling this state on this project, we're not. We're really divided in a very different way. We're divided between our coastal areas and our inland areas. The Central Valley of California and the areas at least east of Los Angeles, known as the Inland Empire, these areas are very different from what goes on in the coastal regions. Along the coasts, you have a stronger economy, better physical environment, a higher concentration of educational institutions, greater job opportunities. The inland areas, which shock some people, in California, the Central Valley of California, known primarily for the fabulous agricultural production, which is based on some of the most productive farmland in the world, is also home to 3 of the 5 most impoverished regions of the United States of America, right here in California. And in terms of physical environment, 21% of the children in the Central Valley suffer from asthma because of the air quality associated with agricultural operations and other things. The unemployment rate is twice the state average, and the unemployment rate among construction workers is even higher than that. This is an area that suffers from massive underinvestment in infrastructure, in technology, in education. It was only in recent years that the 10th campus of the University of California system opened at UC Merced. Now, what are we doing with high-speed rail? Are we just building a fast train? No, we are not. We are connecting regions of the state, including regions that have been left behind. Right now, today, as we sit here, hundreds of men and women are building America's first high-speed rail system in the Central Valley of California. It is the first time in decades that an investment like that has been made in that region of our state. And across the United States, there are regions like that that could benefit from that type of investment. We will be putting $6 billion into just the spine of the system over 130 miles in the Central Valley of California. Today, roughly 250 men and women are working just on the first construction package. We've got 2 more construction packages that are about to get underway. We will probably have, this time next year, close to 1,000 people in direct construction jobs in the Central Valley. That's the first point. The second point is that I'm proud to say that our board has decided that in order to make sure that this investment benefits all Californians, not just some, we have said that 30% of all the contract dollars must go to small business. 3% must go to businesses run by disabled American veterans. And again, if I can just be political for a moment, we live in a time when fewer and fewer Americans shoulder the burden for the defense of our nation. Many of them have come back from foreign wars with physical or other disabilities. It is right and proper that we make sure that they have new opportunities when they come back, and we are doing that. And we are meeting these goals. So what does that mean? That means that $1.8 billion of investment is going to small businesses, and right now there are 266 small businesses in California, many of them in the Central Valley, but throughout California, that are working on this program, and we're just in the first phases. 90 certified disadvantaged business enterprises and 32 certified disabled business enterprises. And I have to take a moment and tell you one story that always makes me feel good whenever we face the challenges that one faces in trying to build a program like this. Catch Environmental Services, run by a disabled veteran named Paul Kachadorian, handles a lot of our environmental remediation work as we go through cities like Fresno and we remove buildings in the path of the construction. They have to be made safe, whether it's asbestos or other toxic materials and so forth. Mr. Kachadorian came back, has built a business on this. Because of the high-speed rail program and the investment that we are making, he has hired 20 different people into his business, and many of them are off of the CalWORKS program, which, for those of you who don't know, is a program that takes people who have been hard to employ, not had skills, and trains them to be able to do this work. And this is a really critical part of what we're doing, is workforce training. And so not only do our labor unions who are working on this have a program called Helmets to Hard Hats to help people who are veterans who are coming back, but we are hiring people who off of these unemployment roles into CalWORKS and other training programs. There was one gentleman that Mr. Kachadorian hired who was formerly homeless and, in fact, was living out of his car. This gentleman bought his first home 2 months ago because of his new employment on this program. So we never can forget that this isn't about statistics. This is about people's lives. And there are going to be many, many more stories like this as we invest and as we build. We can lift people from poverty and, in some cases, hopelessness and help them build America for the future. But as the subject of this conference tells us, we need to make sure that that workforce is there and available to us and is trained. And I will tell you another story, which is very heartening. There's a young woman who's a student at Fresno State University. She's Latina. I believe she was the first in her family to attend college. Her view was that growing up in Fresno meant that there was going to be limited opportunity for her, and that she would, like many of her friends and colleagues, plan on moving away, maybe to the big city sometime in the future. That was before she started to read about high-speed rail. She's an engineering student, or I believe now she may have graduated. She decided that she wanted to stay in her community and build this for her family and her friends and her children. And this inspired her to pursue her engineering studies and to say that she wanted to work on this project. And when people say to me, what is our biggest workforce challenge and how do we deal with it? One of the things that occurs to me is that the first thing we need to do is we have to inspire our young people that there are opportunities here. There are many opportunities. As the Mineta Transportation Institute tells us, we are facing a massive wave of retirement of the current generation of engineers. We are going to need new engineers. Just looking at our program alone, not only do we need engineers to design and build it, we're going to need engineers and we're going to need qualified technicians to run the heavy maintenance facility and the light maintenance facility. And we're going to need all the associated skills with people running operations centers. And we're going to need all of the skills of people who are going to have to be in the support industries, working on maintenance, working on revitalization and design. And then there are going to be new technologies that we're constantly going to want to put into this program. The opportunities here are enormous, And the first thing we have to do is to excite and convince our young people that whether you want to go to college and become an engineer, or you want to go to trade school and become a mechanic or a technician, or that you want to start a business because you can see that the level of economic activity is coming up and that you want to start a support industry, that opportunity is here. And then we need to provide them the means and the tools and the skills to do that. One of the other things that's very exciting to me, having spent time in the Central Valley where we're starting the construction of high-speed rail, is that we're seeing now the vision and the leadership of the academic institution leaders in the Central Valley. What we've realized is if you look at other California industries, if you look at our computer and software industry, and you see the connections back to the universities at Stanford and Berkeley, and the famous stories of Hewlett and Packard and their association with Stanford, and how that university-centric approach has provided the spark, the innovation, the people that have grown that industry. Similarly, in Southern California, Caltech, Cal Poly, USC, UCLA provided the engineering programs that really drove the aerospace industry in Southern California, with people starting new businesses and coming out of those institutions and seeing the direct connection into that industry. Well, you know, high-speed rail is a high-technology program. People say, well, isn't this 19th century steel wheel technology? And my answer is, well, it's no more that than a Tesla is old technology because it runs on rubber tires on fixed guideways. A Tesla is to a 1955 Chevy as a high-speed rail train is to an old locomotive. Why? What is a Tesla? It's got an advanced propulsion system. It has an advanced computer-driven software system. It has a highly aerodynamic design. What is a high-speed rail train? It has an advanced electric propulsion system. It has a highly aerodynamic design. It has advanced technologies for train control and operations. The pantograph, the wing that collects the electric power from the overhead lines, has to be designed in a very sophisticated way to fly as a wing up against those wires to maintain constant contact. People don't think about this. You don't just go down to the metal shop and say, I want one of these. So we are going to need designers, engineers, and innovators to continue to make improvements in this technology into the future. And the leaders of California State University at Bakersfield, of the engineering department at UC Merced, of the engineering department at Fresno State University, and other schools are now saying we need to start training our students to be ready. Because if we're starting in the Central Valley, we in the Central Valley could be the epicenter of a new academic industry connection that provides the human capital that is going to keep this moving. So there are many, many, many opportunities here. And I guess I would just close with this and look forward to your questions and a conversation. This is America's time to invest, and this is America's time to train the next generation. And we should not miss this opportunity. I took note of the fact that the other day, President Obama, reflecting back on his tenure as our nation's leader, said that one of his regrets with respect to the economy was that in the last 3 or 4 years, we had not launched at the national level major infrastructure programs. And the president went on to say, and I believe he's absolutely correct in this, this is the time to build. The interest rates are low. We have labor surpluses, and we have a need. And this is the time to recommit ourselves to making these investments now. And to do that, we're not only going to need to have the will and the courage to take these challenges on, but as today's program shows us, we also need to make parallel investments in the human resources so that the young people of today are the leading engineers and innovators of tomorrow, and that they're providing the skill and the sweat and the backbone to keep the systems moving. We're very proud today to be employing that new generation of Californians, but we're going to need a lot more. We're going to need your help in training them. We're going to need your help in inspiring them, and we're going to put them to work. And the last thing I would say is this. If we build a modern transportation system, we're not done there. If you look around the world, every place that these connections are made, every place that there's a transit hub, what happens? Transit-oriented development builds up around that. And one of the things that I've said to our workforce is, you're not just going to be working on high-speed rail. When high-speed rail is done, people will be building the hotels and the convention centers and the technology centers and the housing and the commercial developments around these stations. We can launch an investment program that has many, many, many concentric rings that, like dropping a stone in a pond, can just keep going and going and going. This is our time to build. This is our time to invest. This is our time to train. I'm very privileged to be here today to share this with you, and I thank you very much for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richard. It's now time for audience question period, and we actually have quite a few questions. We'll try to get through as much of these as we can.
Sure.
So I'm going to start with, and they're still coming in. They're piling up on me. I'm going to start with, it's actually something I was thinking about as you were talking, and then a question came in, so it doesn't have to be my question anymore, but I'll cue it up. I wonder if you would visualize, or since we're on radio, maybe do a kind of a mental map of how the rail will look north and south, but also east and west. And this is the question, so it's, I guess it's kind of a two-part question. Please summarize the high-speed rail completion schedule, Central Valley, Modesto to Bakersfield, Central Valley to Silicon Valley, Bakersfield to San Francisco, Central Valley to L.A., Anaheim. So lay it out for us.
Right now we are building the ultimate high-speed rail system will be 800 miles in California. The first phase is intended to connect Anaheim and Los Angeles up to the San Francisco Bay Area, going east through our Central Valley and then west through San Jose and up into San Francisco. That would be 520 miles from Anaheim through L.A., up through the Central Valley, through Silicon Valley, and to right here in downtown San Francisco, 520 miles. Our current plan is to connect the Central Valley to the Silicon Valley by 2024, opening service in 2025, and then to complete the system, phase one system, down to Los Angeles by 2029. It seems like a long time from now until you look back and try to think of what you were doing only 8 or 9 years ago, and it doesn't seem that long. So we're working very hard. We're trying to find ways to accelerate that. And I will just say quickly that this first leg that will open, even though it doesn't connect the entire state, connecting our Central Valley with the Silicon Valley is really important. I think most people, even across the country, have heard that the housing crisis in the Silicon Valley, in the San Jose, Sunnyvale area, is acute. And for young people, no matter how well some of these companies want to pay, it's extremely difficult to find anything close to affordable housing there. In the Central Valley, where if we do this right and we get the land use right so that we're not inducing sprawl, but that we're building sustainable communities around the transit hubs, we can get people from the Central Valley to San Jose faster than they can currently get from San Francisco to San Jose. So there's an opportunity to balance our high employment areas with areas where housing could be more available to people. And that's one of the things we think is an exciting first step.
In the old days, in the olden days, infrastructure projects were, there was a very deliberate emphasis on investing in infrastructure in ways that created jobs and had employment impacts. It's not so much the case today. We tend to see those things as separate, although with high-speed rail construction, it is very deliberate. As you talked about in your remarks, are there lessons from high-speed rail for other big infrastructure projects in the state Should we be thinking again about infrastructure projects in ways that are related to having employment impacts for people who most need jobs?
I think that if you start by saying that we're just going to make infrastructure investments to create jobs, there are two problems with that. First of all, it doesn't tell you that you're making the right kind of infrastructure investment. Anybody can go out and create a make-work job. We can do things that that may have lasting damage to our physical environment and so forth. So, and I also think that it's corrosive to public confidence if they believe that the entire objective is to just go out and create jobs, as important as creating jobs is. I think you have to start with the need, and this is something that Rod Dierrett and I were discussing just before this program. Start with what is it that we need in our society? We do need a modern transportation system. We do need to build more effective water systems. As we've learned tragically in Flint, Michigan and other places, we've got to upgrade the water systems. We've got to upgrade the waste management systems. There is a lot to do in our country. And that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. So I think that what we can say is we have work to do. Let's get to work. That work will hire people. It will employ people. And it will do meaningful things that will make our society better. So I think we should start with that end of the spectrum. What is the need? And I think any citizen would look around and see in their community that there are needs in every community. And then as we look at the broader picture of connecting our regions and our states, those needs are there and we can get to work and do that, and plenty of people will be employed.
It's a good segue to the next question, or it may not be, but I just say that so the questions work together. Can you summarize again the expected financing of the project? So this does relate to value in creating jobs, but also valuable infrastructure that needs to be there today, but also into the future.
Well, the biggest question we get all the time, because our program currently is estimated for the first phase to cost $64 billion, but that's the fully inflated price over the next 15 years. And that sounds like a huge amount of money, because it is a huge amount of money. But I start with this, which is that we and others have looked at what it would cost to maintain equivalent mobility if we kept building highways and we tried to expand our airports, even if those things could happen. And they're estimated, that path is estimated to cost between $140 and $180 billion. So more than twice or triple what we're talking about here. So when you put it in that perspective, which I think you need to, because we don't have the luxury really of doing nothing. And so it's really about an investment choice. Right now, we have our arms around how we would get about two-thirds of that funding done. And that's both with some federal stimulus act money, with state bond money that our voters voted on in 2008, as well as with money from our greenhouse gas emission control program known as the cap and trade program that the governor proposed and the legislature agreed to allocate to us, 25% of the proceeds of that. We also believe, and this is a very important thing about infrastructure, we believe very much that this program has to be a public-private partnership. If you look at the nation of Japan, which had the world's first high-speed rail system, and by the way, I just have to take a sidebar here, when that opened in 1964, the bullet train, as it was known in Japan, went 135 miles an hour. Today's fourth and fifth generation Japanese trains go about 100 miles an hour faster than that. And they look very different in terms of their aerodynamics, and their systems are better and so forth. So this is a technology that continues to evolve. But in Japan, they privatized their system after the government made the initial investment. And today, private companies run the Japanese Shinkansen, and this is also true in France with the TGV and so forth. This is what we're going to do. So our model here, which is a model for other infrastructure programs, is for the government to put in the first dollars when the risk to the private sector is too high. And even if they would take that risk, they would have to price it in a way that it's too high. The government makes the first investment, demonstrates it, brings the risk down, and invites the private sector to come in and operate, pay us for the opportunity to do that, and use those proceeds to help build out the rest. This is a model that's worked around the world. And I think now what we're seeing is this kind of public-private partnership where government takes the first step to help the private sector reduce its risk and then asks the private sector to come in and bring in their efficiency and their innovation is really a good model to follow.
I want to remind everyone, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Dan Richard, chair of California's High Speed Rail Authority. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. So another question that is related to the last. If there wasn't the vision that Jerry Brown has, Governor Jerry Brown has, for building big infrastructure projects in the past, if there wasn't that kind of vision, we wouldn't have highways, we wouldn't have ports, we wouldn't have airports, public universities. Why is there such, well, there's some opposition. There's not a lot of opposition. I think it's in certain places. But what are the reasons for the lack of political will in some cases to make these kinds of investments?
I think there are several things involved here. So the first thing you mentioned, Tim, is that there are some people who are directly affected by these kinds of infrastructure investments. And you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that when you're making, when you're building things, someone's land may be necessary to acquire in order to build it. It may affect somebody's business. And there are real human impacts. And I have to say, I think it's been important for me and my colleagues to not ignore those. I mean, I have stood in the milking barn of a second-generation Portuguese dairyman in Hanford, California. I've stood in people's businesses where they say, if you come through here, you're going to take my business out. People are looking at their homes being affected. And these are things that are very, very important. And I don't dismiss them as NIMBYism because if somebody were coming to take my house, I think I would react the same way. So we need to approach that with care and sensitivity and humanity and try to do the best we can to limit the impacts. The governor once said, what does it take to build this? And I said, 520 miles, governor, home by home, farm by farm, business by business, adjusting every step of the way to try to minimize impacts. So the first thing is there will always be impacts. We are not a society that is going to bulldoze people out of the way to do this. We have to treat them fairly. They have to be compensated for their loss. But those people will raise objections, and those objections are legitimate objections. I think the more challenging thing is a loss of will and a loss of confidence. And this is something that I've reflected on quite a bit since I've had this opportunity. In the 1950s, going back to the 1940s, people envisioned connecting the San Francisco Bay region with an underwater tube that became our BART system. And every day today, 400,000 trips a day are taken on that system. And I just thank heaven that there were people with vision who were willing to do that when some of those technologies did not even exist. We take it for granted today. But we've seen things like the Big Dig. We've seen things here in San Francisco like our new Oakland Bay Bridge that went way over budget. And people lose confidence. And we also, unfortunately, in my view, live in a time when people's general confidence in government to be competent, to solve their problems, to address their problems, is at a very, very low ebb. And I think this is corrosive, and I think it's poisonous, and we have to fight it. Because as Americans, we have built this incredible society for people. As Californians, we have had tremendous achievements. And yet, somehow, we're lacking confidence that we can do this as we move into the future. And part of why I think it's so important to excite young people about the possibility is we've got to get our mojo back. We've got to have this belief that we can do these things. And from my part, I feel it's very incumbent on us at the High Speed Rail Authority that we have to do it right. We spend a lot of time looking at risk management. We spend a lot of time looking at oversight because we don't want to screw this up. If we screw this up and it gets into huge construction problems and overruns and so forth, it's not only going to set us back, but it's going to set back the cause across the country. So I apologize for the long answer, but I really think it comes down to care and humanity with respect to people who are directly affected, but beyond that, convincing ourselves that we can do these things and we're going to.
What do you see ahead as potential roadblocks that could affect the timely completion of high-speed rail? You put on your prognosticator's hat. What do you think you see in terms of risk management, what we need to be looking at down the road, so to speak?
Well, I think that there are, you know, many things. I mean, first of all, we live in a very litigious society, and our program's already been delayed by litigation. And the litigation is not behind us. As we move to build future segments, people will challenge that. So there's always that. The funding could come more slowly than we want. And again, going back to the notion that this is the time to build, this really would be the time for Congress and others to get together and say, you know, an infrastructure reinvestment program that combined public dollars with encouragement for private sector investment is exactly what would be the right thing to help turbocharge America's economy right now. And by the way, even though inflation is low, there is inflation, so the faster you help us build it, the cheaper it will be. So we do face those challenges. There will certainly be engineering challenges, and people have talked about going across the mountains and so forth. Union Pacific Railroad crossed the Tehachapi Mountains in the 1800s with picks and shovels. I think we're going to find a way to do it in the 21st century, actually. So I'm not as concerned about that. But that's not to say that, you know, up in Seattle, they had a tunnel boring machine that went awry. Things happen, and things will continue to happen. Our challenge is not to pretend that there won't be challenges. Our challenge is to convince people that we will address them quickly and meet them well, and to get this done.
Just to change gears a little bit, or maybe a lot, get into the question of global warming. Science stresses that global warming is out of control with the U.S. And is as a prime source of that pollution. Governor Brown, as you know, is an international leader in looking at and supporting and being active and a leader on remedies for global warming and taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Can you talk a little bit about how high-speed rail fits into that effort?
Certainly. So first of all, I'm glad you mentioned the governor's leadership on this. Governor Brown was in Paris for the international conference. He has been one of the strongest voices on the planet for the urgent need for all societies to take action on this. And I mentioned before that California right now is the world's eighth largest economy. So think about it this way. We talk about, well, what should China do? What should India do? What should America do? But what should California do? As a standalone entity, we'd be the eighth largest economy in the world. We have a moral obligation to address this, and our governor has taken that very much to heart. In California, because we're actually different, if you look across the United States, a large bulk of the greenhouse gas emissions come from the energy sector, particularly states that depend on coal. So in many places across the country, 40 or 45% of their greenhouse gas emissions come from energy and about 20% come from transportation. In California, it's the reverse. In California, 43 or 45% of our emissions come from the transportation sector and far less from the energy sector because we have moved in the direction of renewables and energy efficiency quite aggressively. So when you have 43% of your greenhouse gas emissions coming from the transportation sector, what must you do? Well, one of the things you do is you electrify the transportation sector using the new clean energy technologies that can power that. And so high-speed rail is leading the way not only to create an intercity electrified rail system, but to help make partnership investments So, for example, here between San Francisco and San Jose, there's a very popular, highly utilized diesel commuter rail system, heavy rail. Well, we're working with Caltrain, as it's known, to invest, to upgrade that to electric service. So we need to electrify our urban and interregional transportation systems, look for new fuels for our vehicles, look for new ways to power this, and we have those. Because right now in California, we actually have, on many days, surplus of solar energy resources, and putting that surplus into electrified transportation makes all the sense in the world. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, by using high-speed rail as a tool, as many of our mayors are looking at it, to revitalize their downtown cores and rebuild downtown areas as opposed to sprawl-based growth, that has an enormous impact on reducing and controlling greenhouse gas emissions in the future. So direct electrification of transportation and using transportation as a tool for transit-oriented development are two very, very key strategies we have here in California under our governor's leadership.
Great. In many industries, we've talked about this a little bit. We're in San Francisco, so I think this is a very relevant question for where we're sitting. Many workers can't afford to live in the cities where they work. So are you concerned about this? I know you are. And in high-speed rail and other transit systems in California, how does that fit in?
You know, we were, I did mention this before. I mean, we're here in San Francisco, which when I got here in 1978, San Francisco was very much a blue-collar city. But today, the police officers and firefighters and a lot of other workers can't live in the city. They have to live outside the city and come to their jobs here. And we do see high-speed rail as providing not only an opportunity for broad-based intercity travel, but also to help get workers from some of the outlying areas into these cities. And I remember that we were on a trade mission to China in 2013 that Governor Brown led, and we were it was an amazing thing. We were on a night high-speed rail train from Shanghai to Beijing, from Beijing to Shanghai. And we're rocketing through the Chinese countryside at almost 200 miles an hour. And a reporter came up to me and said, well, this is very nice up here in business class. You know, are you guys building this as kind of a Lexus lane for, you know, the wealthy? And I said, why don't you walk back about three cars? Because what you'll see is 3x3 sitting with Chinese workers going from one city to the other. And I'm told this is true in Japan and other places. So we are trying to build this for all Californians, and I think there will be opportunities for people to not just use high-speed rail, but this broader rail modernization to find ways to connect jobs and housing.
So it may be decades ahead, but once high-speed rail is completed, what do you believe will be the next major transportation issue the state is going to have to grapple with?
You know, the governor talks about having been governor in the 70s and then again in a modern time. He said, you know, a lot of the problems are still the same. And he made a very interesting observation that these are not problems so much as conditions that we live with. And we will probably, 20 years ago on the BART system, we revitalized BART and we extended the life of the rail cars. Well, 20 years is up. Time to do this. So I think we will always be facing this. We will always need to invest. We will always need to improve. And where and when specifically, I don't know. But I think that that these conditions will always be with us, which, by the way, is the other reason that we need to keep training, we need to keep building, we need to keep educating people, because each generation will essentially face the same types of challenges. Even though they may not be the same challenges, they'll be the same types of challenges. Somebody 20 or 30 years from now will be working on how to improve mobility, how to improve air quality, how to make sure that water quality is there, how to deal with housing. And that's why I said I really believe that if you had to boil it down to two things, build a physical infrastructure that can sustain society and make that investment in human capital so that we know how to do that.
So because we're going to segue into a bunch of workforce speak later on with a couple of panels, I wanted to kind of cue that up and get your thoughts on kind of broader workforce issues. Maybe actually, if I could drill in a little bit on where the high-speed rail construction is starting in Fresno County, and the difficulty of ensuring that people in the community have access to these wonderful jobs, and what the High-Speed Rail Authority has done to ensure that there are jobs for the people who live in the communities where the construction is happening.
Well, I'm very proud of what we've done so far, and we need to continue to do it and expand it. But we work very closely with the men and women in the construction industry trades who are building this, and we entered into a community benefits agreement with them that not only provides for labor stability, but also for massive amounts of training, workforce development training. And so we do have apprenticeship programs. I think we have 174 people who've come out of the apprenticeship programs. We are very much focused on encouraging local hire because we want to make sure that as we're coming into these communities that they are benefiting. And so I think a really heavy emphasis on local hire, things like the Helmets to Hard Hat program for returning veterans, apprenticeship training, things like we have here in California called CalWorks, which is taking people who've been hard to employ and training them. But I would also say one other thing that's very important is making sure that we have these set-asides for small businesses. Small businesses, I used to run a small business for 15 years. We employed about 30 people. Felt really good to create jobs for people. Small businesses create a tremendous number of jobs. We've got one business in that actually provides traffic management services in construction zones. They're planning to hire a dozen people just to do traffic management in the construction zones. So I think when you start to look at saying it's not just the big contractors, but and the other thing is we go in and we move a business out of the way. We say, well, this is the alignment. They take a restaurant and they rebuild it someplace else. Guess what? They need carpenters, they need laborers, they need glaziers, they need plasterers to rebuild that restaurant. So again, trying to look at this in a holistic way and say, what kind of direct employment are we creating? What kind of indirect employment can we create? And along the way, can we, you know, to use the old biblical adage, not just give someone a fish, but teach them how to fish so that they can sustain themselves throughout their lives. If you lose sight of that when you're trying to build something like this, we've missed a huge opportunity.
The next panel, the folks who are coming up after we're done here, we'll I think get into more detail about workforce programs. Councilmember Baines from the City of Fresno will be here, and he can talk a lot about the access to apprenticeship programs and the fantastic work that's going on in Fresno with the Local Building Trades Council and Chuck Riojas. Do you anticipate or see the possibility of the model that's developing in Fresno around ensuring access to good jobs for people who most need good jobs? Do you anticipate that model possibly transferring to other parts of the state and other communities as the high-speed rail construction continues?
Well, this is one of the things that we're very excited about. It's not just the construction. You know, we're going through an agricultural area. We ended up having a settlement with one of the farm groups about how we treat agricultural parcels that get divided. We just decided this is the right policy, and we're just going to apply it across all the other parts of the state where we're doing similar work. And that's an analog to what we're learning in this first stage of construction about how to do workforce development. And so this is a great laboratory. There's a lot of work underway right now. Our first three contracts are close to $3 billion worth of work. That's an enormous amount of work. And we want to work very closely with the workforce investment boards and with other experts in employment and so forth to not only do this, but to assess our progress and our success as we're going and to make adjustments so that we can be better and more efficient in what we're doing. But we absolutely plan to replicate these what we like to think are very forward-looking, very aggressive employment development programs as we go through the state, maybe making, you know, the socioeconomic status of different cities will vary, but I think the basic model of making sure there's a set aside for small businesses, making sure there's aggressive training and development programs, really looking to get to local hires as much as possible, and reaching out to people who have been desperate and hard to employ. And, you know, transportation should not be a political, partisan, or ideological issue. As the saying goes, there are no Democratic or Republican potholes. And so what we're looking at here is, in many cases, not only making sure that we have the workforce that we need to get this done, but taking people who are currently leaning on the social safety net, who need public assistance to provide health care or other well-being for their families, giving them jobs and turning them into taxpayers. I can't imagine why that would be a political issue for anybody of any stripe.
Well, as the director of the California Workforce Development Board, I want to say that I'm excited for the opportunity to work with you in helping to organize community colleges, workforce boards, community-based organizations to help develop the kinds of systems and investments that will help meet your vision on how that unfolds across the state of California.
Thank you for that, and I'm glad you mentioned the community colleges, because I was talking about our universities and state college system before, but for many, many skilled workers, the community colleges are going to provide a tremendous base for training. And so I think at all levels of our education system, you know, if we do this right, this is a tremendously exciting time. Our estimates are that we could have 20,000 Californians directly or indirectly employed in this program, just in this program. And then you get all the other ancillary things that come off of that. And that's why we're so excited about this opportunity.
Well, we have, unfortunately, just time for one more question. And since I'm moderator, it gets to be mine. So I'm an appointee of Governor Brown, very proudly. Although I get a salary, you don't. As far as I understand, you work for free for Governor Brown.
They pay me $500 a month.
Okay. So. I stand corrected. So my question is, what motivates you?
Workforce development.
What motivates you to do this work? You know, where do you draw your passion from? You put a lot of time into this. This is probably more than a full-time job in addition to your real job. What drives you?
You know, I guess I would just say, like many, many, many people in our country, you know, I look back, my grandparents coming to this country from Europe, seeing this as a place of opportunity. I remember my son, when he was in high school, going to Russia on a people-to-people trip and coming back and saying to me, you know, I never understood what the word opportunity meant before. And I think for a lot of us who've had the blessings of being able to go to college, being able to build a good life, you know, what is it you want to leave behind? And, you know, I've been fortunate, and I have to say that it doesn't matter. I feel privileged that the governor has put confidence in me and my colleagues to take on what is America's largest infrastructure project. And, you know, in the same way that I look back with admiration at the people who built our BART system, the people who built the Golden Gate Bridge, the people who built the world's largest hydroelectric complex, privately owned here in California, I'd like to be able to say that, you know, we left something, that we left something good, and you know, helped people build their lives in the future. And having the opportunity to do that is really a great privilege. But I think that is what fuels me, is just I feel that we have a moral obligation to future generations. And we have a governor who very deeply feels this, that we're not just here to take, but that we're here to give back. And if we can make this happen and we can improve people's lives, that's something to look back on with great satisfaction.
It's my honor and my pleasure to have had the opportunity to be your moderator today. As a citizen of California, thank you for your service.
Thanks. Thank you.
So our thanks to Dan Richard, chair of California's High Speed Rail Authority. Today's program is co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute, San Jose State University, and the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center. We want to thank our audiences here and on the radio and television and the internet. We also want to remind everyone in this room that following the conclusion of this portion of the program, our panel discussion will take place following an approximately 5-minute pause to reset the stage. I'm Tim Rainey of the California Workforce Development Board, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.